chapter 4 today. If you have your Bible, if you can turn to it, we're going to be going through it and looking at it. And John chapter 4 is it's a relatively familiar passage if you've been in the church, if you've attended church for a little while, because it is one that has a very unique story to it. There's a question that I wanted to ask of it, and this is just kind of the big broad question that's going to draw us into our discussion. But the big broad question that I've always wondered about this is, why does this woman come to faith? You know, why does this woman make this decision at this point in time based on this conversation? Because it's a weird conversation. You know, I've never had a conversation like this with someone that's led them to Christ. You know, it's a very strange conversation. It isn't the four spiritual laws of, you know, let me show you this, and let me tell you this, and let me get you here. It's a very unique conversation. And so it really kind of brought up this question of, why does this woman come to faith? Now, having said that, I want to explain that there's something very unique going on in our day and age. We have this cultural dialogue going on, and the dialogue has actually shifted even over the last 6 months. The cultural dialogue is about our religion. Is religion beneficial? Is religion good? And essentially, the cultural dialogue has swung to the far end, especially with a lot of things happening recently, to where more and more people are saying all religions are dangerous. No, all religions are dangerous. And they root it in some very basic things. They say, well, what makes religion so dangerous is the fact that religions make these truth claims. Now, again, this is obvious, but all religions make truth claims. I don't believe that means that, just based on that, I don't think that means that every religion is dangerous. But that's what a lot of people will say. You know, kind of drawing blank on something. You don't just have people who are how am I missing this? What do you call people who don't believe in God? Atheists, sorry. For a second I didn't believe in them. But you know, you have people who are atheists. What you're actually having in this cultural dialogue is you're getting anti-theists. You know, you're getting people who are actively saying that religion is a bad thing, that it's a dangerous thing. And a lot of the reason is to say it's these truth claims. You know, the reason why these truth claims are dangerous is because if you believe these truths and other people don't believe these truths, then you can attack them, you can challenge them, whether that's verbally, whether that's emotionally, whether that's physically, and that's leading to all these problems. The problem in the world is fundamentalists. And you can label that however you want, Christian fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists, whatever. But that's essentially the cultural dialogue going on, is that religion is dangerous because religion at its heart has these truth claims. Now, what I want to show you today is that truth by itself really isn't the swaying factor, because every religion makes truth claims. As a matter of fact, everyone makes truth claims even if you're not religious. Atheists make truth claims. Scientists make truth claims. You know, everyone makes truth claims. You have to in order to live in this world. But the question is this: what type of truth claims do you make? Because in a very basic way, if your truth is essentially rules and regulations, then you can become militant over those things. And what I want to show you today is that it's my belief, and of course, I'm probably biased in this, but it's my belief that the truth claims that Christianity makes are more beautiful and thus far more compelling than any other religion. And what's unique is if your truth is both true and beautiful, then it leads you to a very different place. So that's really kind of the jumping off point for me, is really asking this question of, why does this woman come to faith? And that's what gets us into John chapter 4. I think John chapter 4 shows us that that Christianity is unique, that it's beautiful, and that ultimately it is compelling. So as we go through this passage, I want to show you three things about what we see about the gospel. First thing we see is we see the reach of the gospel. We see how far the gospel goes. Second thing we see is the need of the gospel. We see some very pointed questions and conversation about thirst, about need. Third thing we see is we see the joy of the gospel as the conversation wraps up, as they talk about worship. So first, reach, the reach of the gospel. Second, the need for the gospel. Third thing, joy in the gospel. So first, the reach of the gospel. Let me go back to verse 7 through 9 and read that for us. But in 7 through 9, we already find out what's taking place in the story. Jesus is traveling, and he meets up with this woman at this well, who comes to him as he's sitting at this well in Samaria, and says, "A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, 'Give me a drink,' for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, 'How is it that you, a Jew, asks for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?' For Jews had no dealings with Samaritans." Now, that's the beginning interaction. Again, we have the background in the few verses up before it, but we see that Jesus is traveling from Judea, which is in the south, to Galilee, which is in the north. And essentially what he does is he stops about halfway up, about halfway through his travels, which lands him right in the middle of Samaria at this particular well. He stops because it's middle of the day, he's hot, he's tired, he's thirsty. This woman comes to the well at the same time and happens to run into him. Just to give you a little background that some of you already know, but this is important, and we see it even through the conversation that Jews and Samaritans have this intense hatred. Matter of fact, the hatred's probably more on the Jewish side than on the Samaritan side, but we see it in the conversation. The woman says, "Why are you talking to me? You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan." So she recognizes the fact that there's a lot of bad blood, bad history between the two. Just to give you a little bit more background, this is something that has been percolating for at least 700 years since the fall of the northern and southern kingdoms. So this is something that's long lasting. When the kingdoms were divided in the Old Testament, what ended up happening is you had a northern kingdom, you had a southern kingdom. In the northern kingdom, in this area of Samaria, the people that they call the Samaritans at this time began to intermarry. And so that was actually a big reason for hatred, is Jews hated Samaritans because they weren't racially pure. They were half-breeds. They were mixed marriages, mixed races. But it actually went much, much deeper than that. Jews hated Samaritans because not only were they racially mixed, they were spiritually mixed. They'd taken pieces of other religions, they had kind of meshed it together. And when the kingdoms were divided, they even went to the point of the Samaritans had built their own temple, and in Jewish custom and Jewish law, that was absolutely forbidden. And so here you have Jesus, a Jew, you have this woman who comes to the well, a Samaritan, and there are so many reasons why they should hate each other, why they should not talk to each other. And the reasons are racial, the reasons are spiritual. Matter of fact, I would tell you that the one thing I found out as I went through this is the hatred apparently between Jews and Samaritans was so severe that if you were traveling the way Jesus was, most Jews would actually go around Samaria, even if that meant extra time, extra expense, because they didn't want to go through. It was just it, that that's how intense the hatred was between these two people. But yet we jump into chapter 4, and here is Jesus talking to the Samaritan woman. Now, I want to point you to something because a lot of the scholars kind of see that John is putting his gospel together in a very purposeful way. But what a lot of them say is they say chapter 4 essentially is a commentary on John 3:16. So if you look at John 3:16, it says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life." And if you remember, there's a unique word in there that's important, which is whoever, that whoever believes. And so what John is showing us in chapter 3 and chapter 4 is that the whoever who can come to believe in Christ is both Nicodemus, the man, a Jewish man who is upright, who is moral, who is a Pharisee, but the gospel also has room for the Samaritan woman. John 3:16 is this incredible statement that says how far the gospel actually reaches out. That it reaches out to religious people, and it reaches out to people that religious people hate. And if you were to be able to sit down with Jesus' disciples, and if you were to hear him talk about this, to tell them John 3:16, to explain that, they would all nod their heads. They go, "Jesus, that's great. I completely agree with you." But then if you were to ask them, "Well, who's the whoever?" they would all say, "Well, they're Jews." The disciples themselves could never fathom that the Messiah would come, that the gospel would come for someone like the Samaritan woman. And so in chapter 4, what we're seeing is we're seeing a, John is trying to show us, and Jesus is showing us through his interactions, he's trying to show us how far the gospel can go. Matter of fact, if you look at Jesus' life, one of the things that becomes incredibly interesting is you begin to realize that Jesus had conversations, he had relationships with people that went far beyond what anyone else would, far beyond what any religious leader at the time would have, far beyond what any Jew at the time would have. He talked to more people in different strata, more people than most people would interact with in at this period of time at all. Well, why is that? It's because that's where the gospel goes. The gospel goes far beyond the reaches where we think it can go. It goes for and it goes to whoever. And that includes people that we would never imagine, that we would never include, that we would never say, yeah, this is for them. Now, instead of kind of going on and talking about what that meant in an ancient culture, I want to tell you what it means for us. Because there is a very direct application. The application or the implication is this. It means that for each of us, if we are people of the gospel, it means that the gospel should make us more welcoming, more loving, more open, more inclusive. Because we believe something that doesn't tighten up the reins and lock all the doors. We believe in something, and because our hearts have been captured by something that is far-reaching, that says, whoever, whoever may believe. Skip Ryan says it this way, and I think it's a perfect way to say this. He says, the surest sign of someone understanding grace is that he doesn't expect or even want to have church with people just like himself. I think that's a good way to put it. What the gospel does is it begins to open you up, and that happens in your public life, that happens in your personal life. When you really begin to understand the gospel in the right way, it doesn't make you more judgmental. It doesn't make you closed off. It doesn't make you intolerant. It doesn't make you militant. See, a truth can't claim by itself doesn't turn you into those things. It's the nature of the truth claim that twists or turns you. And so here is a truth claim that is loving, that is generous, that is kind, that is open. Here is a truth claim that is welcoming. Here is a truth claim that is inclusive in a way that even the most liberal, inclusive person might not see it. What the gospel does is the gospel comes in and it makes you far more loving than you could ever be. It challenges you and it brings people into your life that are far different than you could ever imagine. And you find yourself befriending and loving people who are vastly different than you, that you would never imagine ever being side by side with. And if you see that happening in your life, it's proof that the gospel is working in your heart. If you don't see that happening, it means that you really don't believe that you're saved by God's grace. There's a part of you that still believes that there's something special, there's something unique about you. And whenever you feel that, it still lets you look down on people, it still lets you treat people poorly. But what we find out is the gospel reaches all. And if that's really the case, then we become people who become open to all. And that should be indicative of the church too. How do you know when the gospel is really working in a church? Well, the church becomes less about cliques and small groups of friends. The church becomes a place where anyone comes in, and even if they're dressed different, even if they look different, even if they smell different, they find love and acceptance. They find kindness, they find grace, and they find hope. I could give you tons of stories of people who, because they weren't dressed the right way, because they didn't fit in a certain financial strata, because they didn't say things a certain way, because they didn't enjoy the same things, could they walk into churches and there's no one there for them to be friends with. There's no community there for them at all. And unfortunately, that says that the gospel really hasn't engaged their hearts. But when the gospel engages our hearts, it makes you realize that you are a whoever who is reached. And then you begin to see everyone else as a whoever. And that evens out all the differences. That flattens out all the things that can separate us. And you begin to have these really interesting relationships with people that you would never imagine. I can tell you that as a pastor, it hasn't happened to me as much as it should have, but I can tell you, being a pastor and a Christian for a certain amount of time, I definitely have people in my life that I look back and go, boy, if I wasn't a Christian, I don't know if I could be, I don't know if I'd have all these different types of friends. But ultimately, that's what the gospel does, is it shows you the far reach, and that opens your eyes, and you begin to love and to express kindness to people that you would never imagine. But that's the first thing we see. What happens is you can imagine the picture, but the disciples come back, and here's Jesus sitting with this woman, and they could never imagine. They could never imagine their rabbi sitting with a woman like this, and yet here he is. Second thing we see here is we see need for the gospel. Let me go to verse 10 and let me read through verse 18, a little bit of an extended section. But starting in verse 10, it says, Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." Now, this entire kind of back and forth is this really mysterious conversation about thirst, about water. Obviously, Jesus is using a physical reality to shed light on a spiritual reality. He's talking about living water, and what he's talking about is he's talking about the grace of God, about this wonderful grace of God that will satisfy our souls. And his message is very simple to this woman. His message is he's showing her that she is someone who is spiritually thirsty. She might not recognize it, she might not acknowledge it, but there is a reason for the things that she is doing. And the reason why she has the life she has, the reason why she's at where she's at, is because there is a spiritual thirst that she has not quenched yet. Every single one of us is in the same position in the sense that all of us are spiritually thirsty. That's a universal. Doesn't matter where you're born, when you're born, who you're born to, what race you are, what age you live in. It doesn't matter. All those things don't matter. Every single person, all of us, are people who are in need of God's grace. And we may not know it. We may not acknowledge it. We may not admit to it. But it's true. That's one of the reasons why all of us feel a sense of aimlessness, emptiness, dissatisfaction. It's that all of us have that feeling of Christmas Eve. You remember Christmas Eve? Christmas Eve is that feeling that there's that one thing out there that if you could just have it, it would make everything right. All of us have that feeling. And we attach that to different things. For some of us, we say that one thing that I need is a husband or a wife. And some of you are in that stage of saying, "Boy, if I could just find someone, if I could just find someone, then all the headaches, all the heartaches would be gone, lonely nights, et cetera, the aimlessness, the emptiness, all the things that I'm feeling, that would make things right." For others of you, it might not be finding someone, it might be getting away from someone. Maybe saying, "I can't wait to go to college because when I go to college, I'll have freedom. I'll be away from my parents. I'll be away from all these rules, all these things that I have to do." And that's the Christmas present waiting for you. That proves that there is a thirst in our hearts. That feeling, that longing, that saying to yourself, "Boy, if I just had this." And again, we could put it on many things. We could put it on relationships. We could put it on freedom. We could say it's money. We could say it's reputation. All these different things. It's proof. It's proof that something's wrong. It's proof that in our souls, we're still thirsty. It's proof that we're empty, that we're missing something. Matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why in this conversation they're talking about water. And what does Jesus say in verse 16? He says, "Go call your husband." Now, Jesus isn't trying to be a jerk. He isn't trying to just point out the one thing because Jesus knows it all. He's not going, "Let me just throw a curveball here and let me bring out the one area she probably doesn't want to talk about at all." No. The reason why he does it is because there's an absolute connection. This is a woman who is spiritually thirsty. So what is her spirit? How has she tried to quench her spiritual thirst? She looked for it in lovers, in husbands, in family. And what she should have realized a long time ago is that husband after husband after husband, relationship after relationship, none of it does what she wants it to do. None of it fixes her. Now, there are moments of happiness in all of that. There are moments of satisfaction in all of that. But at the end of the day, when everything is over, she says, I'm still not fixed. And see, that's what we're looking for. We're spiritually thirsty because something, we need something to fix us. We know that something's wrong. We don't know what it is. And we don't know what'll fix it. And we imagine that all these things will do it. And so Jesus brings us up because that's her idol. That's her sore spot. That's the well that she's trying to drink at. Matter of fact, let me read you Jeremiah 2. You don't have to turn to it, but in Jeremiah 2:13, prophet speaks this from God to the people. But he says, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and hewn out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." You know, what Jeremiah 2 is saying is saying that we have this thirst that we cannot quench. And one of the problems with this thirst is we keep going to things that are not living water. And we try to drink from those things. And they might satisfy us for a moment, but all of a sudden we feel more thirsty. Because that's what broken cisterns do. Broken cisterns don't just leak out water, they also let things leach in. And so if you're drinking from a broken cistern, in the moment, your thirst is being quenched, but because of all the things that are leaching in, the minerals, the dirt, everything else, the contaminants, you find yourself more thirsty. And God is saying, that's what's happening to you. Jesus is saying, that's what's going on in your life. Your problem isn't that you haven't found the right man, the right husband, the right lover. The problem is that you're looking in the wrong place. And that's our problem. The problem isn't that you don't have enough money yet. You know, for someone who says, all it is money, they get to a certain point, they go, you know, I thought it would be this much, it's not this much, it's more. So they have to go for more, they have to go for more, they have to go for more. The problem isn't that you don't have enough of it. The problem is that you're looking for the wrong thing. And, you know, we're fooled because those counterfeits do quench our thirst for a moment. They do give us moments of happiness, moments of peace, moments of satisfaction, but it's fleeting. It disappears. And there's a reason why. The thirst goes far deeper than any of these things can reach. And so any of those things will help for a moment, but it will not last. It will not fix you. And you see, that's the problem we have, right? We try all these things and none of them fix us. They don't fix us. Now, here's a woman again, broken marriages, broken relationship, messed up life. And she should realize that these relationships never did what they promised to do. But just like her, all of us are trying to quench our thirst with something. And one of the questions we have to ask is, what is that? You know, what am I trying to quench my thirst with? And again, this is something, if you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, this all applies. Now, one of the things that I've come to learn is that whenever I am spiritually thirsty, it tells me one thing. Whenever I feel that emptiness, that dissatisfaction, that aimlessness, that thirst, it tells me that I need Christ. You know, that's what you need. That's what I need. Need is a good thing. Need is an important thing. Need tells you to look for the thing that will fix you. Matter of fact, just to give you another example, I know back when I was younger, one of the big causes was hunger in Africa, you know, especially Ethiopia and some of those areas. One of the things that I had read was interesting, but they were saying how these mothers in certain parts of Africa and Ethiopia, they would feed their kids with these blades of grass that they would find. And the reason why they would feed them this particular type of grass is that the kids would eat it, and then they would stop crying, they would stop complaining about being hungry, they would seem to be satisfied. But in reality, what was happening was the grass would go in because their bodies couldn't digest it. It would keep their stomachs full. And then the children would just die because they wouldn't be hungry. They wouldn't seek out any food. They wouldn't, and because they weren't taking anything in, because they didn't feel a hunger, they wouldn't eat and the bodies would shut down and they would die. There's something very, very important, something very good about need. The fact that you feel aimless, the fact that you feel lost, the fact that you feel empty, the fact that you feel dissatisfied is actually a very good thing if you realize what that truly is. It's not a thirst for relationships. It's not a thirst for money. It's not a thirst for power, for fame. It's not a thirst for any of those things. Ultimately, what you feel is you feel a thirst for God, that only God can fix you. And that's Jesus' message to this woman, that only God can fix her. The third thing that we see, and this kind of dovetails into this idea of need, is we also see the joy of the gospel. Let me get us to verse 19. I think that's where we left off. But the conversation changes again. It goes from water to the husband, and I've just kind of explained how that's connected. Now it goes from the husband to worship. It says, verse 19, the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to a woman, "Believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You will worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." Now, I need to explain something. I've always misunderstood this passage for a long time, but it goes from they're talking about living water. Jesus seems to change the subject, talking about husband, even though it's connected. And for a long time, I thought that the woman was changing the subject again. Now Jesus says, "Well, how about your husband?" And she's like, "Oh my gosh, I have all these husbands," and that she's kind of thinking of the spiritual response. Okay, well, let me give you a theological question, Jesus. And it seems like a very strange kind of shift for her to make. I've always seen it that way, that she's trying to throw him off the scent because they're talking about something very personal. But Skip Ryan says this, and I've read it now in a couple other places, but Skip Ryan actually says that what's happening is the woman isn't changing the subject at all. Says the woman actually is beginning to make all the right connections. She's beginning to understand the implications. She's beginning to see. She's beginning to see that if the living water comes into her, it will affect her joy and her worship. She's beginning to see all that it will do. She realizes that. If she stops drinking from this broken cistern, if she tr stops chasing after relationships and men, and if she finds her thirst quenched in God only, she realizes that her worship will change. And she wants to find out what that means. Jesus, if I really do this, how is that going to change? Because my worship is different than your worship. And for the woman, what's happening is she's understanding that with this change, it's going to bring her into true joy, that it will absolutely fix what's wrong. And you see, that's one of the beautiful things about this is what the gospel does is the gospel doesn't just come in as a truth claim of believe this. The gospel comes in, and when you do believe it, it leads to joy, it leads to worship. Because this isn't just something else that you sip at that does all the same things that everything else does. You begin to drink at it and you finally feel satisfied. You finally feel whole. You finally feel like you're fixed. And when that happens, you begin to worship. There's true joy. For the woman, she's kind of asking that question, is this going to fix me? Is this going to make me different? And if I become different, how is this going to affect my religion? How is this going to affect my worship? The gospel absolutely fixes you. The gospel comes in and it fills your heart because it tells you of a love that is deep and satisfying, and it tells you that that love will never go away. And you see, that's what makes Christianity unique. Every religion, every non-religion has a truth claim. The problem with religions isn't that they have truth claims and that creates fights and that creates arguments and that leads to militaristic movements. The question we have to see is that we have to ask, what is your truth claim? Because if your truth claim is rooted in rules and rights, then you will clash. You will become judgmental. You will become angry, and you will argue tooth and nail. But if your truth is rooted in love and kindness, if the truth claim that you hold on to is a truth claim that is merciful and kind, then it will not turn you into an ogre. What it will do is it will become more compelling to you, and it will transform you to the very bottom of your soul. See, rules don't reach that far. Love does. You know, as we talked about, this is a new series, and really the question that that we were saying that Jesus answers all throughout the Gospel of John is this question: why should I believe? Here's why you should believe. Why should I believe this truth? Why did this woman believe this truth? The reason why is very simply because this truth that she was hearing, she recognized this was a joyful truth. It was a truth that was packed in and built in love. Matter of fact, in verse 23, we see something very, very interesting. But in 23, Jesus has this cryptic answer. He says, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth." Jesus uses this concept, verse 21, verse 23, of the hour. And it's a very cryptic word. It's spread out all throughout John's gospel. John tends to record the times where Jesus says statements like this, but it's a code word and it's a trigger word. And essentially, it's a trigger. It's Jesus' code to say, what is the hour? Well, it's his death. He says, there's coming a time where everything will change. And when this hour comes, you will finally be fixed. And when you are fixed, you will rejoice. Why should you believe? You should believe because what is that hour? That hour is Jesus. Jesus will one day go and he will die on the cross, and that will change everything. And you see, it's that truth that will fix you. If you want to believe in truth that is rules and regulations, it will make you hard and stubborn. It will make you rigid. And ultimately, it will make you militant. But if you believe in a truth that's rooted in Jesus' death, that's rooted in his death that was born out of his love, then that will always make you kind and compassionate. Why did this woman believe? Because of the truth, not just because it was true, but because it was this truth. Because it was a truth rooted in love, that one day her Savior would come and that he would lay down his life for her. Is that your truth? Because if it is, that will fix you. Now, having said that, we're going to be joining together to take communion. And communion is rooted in that truth. Communion is rooted in the fact that at the heart of our faith is the suffering and the death of Jesus Christ. Communion reminds us that Christianity isn't about rules. We don't have the Ten Commandments laying out here, and as you take each piece, you commit yourself to following the Ten Commandments or following the other rules that are in the Old Testament. Communion reminds us that the heart of all the truth claims that Jesus makes are love, which are rooted in his death and his resurrection. And again, if that's the source of your truth, if that's the nature of your truth, then all it can do is it can fix you and it can make you a kind, generous, loving, thoughtful, merciful, gracious person. And when you become that, you realize you have been fixed. So having said that, I'm going to ask if the deacons can come up to help serve communion. And as they make their way up here, let's take a moment to reflect. Let's also take a moment to pray. And let's ask God to use this communion time to renew our hearts and to root us again into this wonderful, joyful truth that we have in front of us. Let's pray.